We were discussing something at the end of last class, and where did we leave off? What was I asking the question of? Okay, so we talked about the fact that the king will continue to take. You know, the idea in 1 Samuel 8 that he will take. And what we were looking at was the fact that, or what we were comparing and contrasting was, what's the difference between a judge and a king? You know, we'll go back to 1 Samuel 8, look at verse 20. Well, we'll start in verse 19. So 1 Samuel 8, verse 19. Says, nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us. Verse 20 says, that we also may be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And so I gave you a compare and contrast list. You know, Othniel was one of the judges, and he judged. And when it talks about going out before, you could take that in several different ways. I took it to mean to lead them into battle. There's other things that you could associate that with. But Othniel judged and he warred. So did Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon. And then it says that ruled over. It said that Abimelech ruled over them. So what's the difference? I'm going to ask this question again because it was a good place to leave off and it's a good place to pick up as we move into Saul being anointed king. It's a good place to pick up. So what is the difference between a judge and a king?
One difference, the judges ruled in localities, certain areas, whereas the king was the universal ruler.
Okay.
And whether or not that's the reason God did not want them to have a king, I do not know, but it happens when a judge goes wrong, maybe the people in his area go wrong. But when a king goes wrong, the whole nation goes wrong. And we see that in religion today, churches that have a centralized government.
We do. So I agree that if a judge rules in a certain location and they're a bad judge, maybe it's just the location that's affected. A king is over the nation. For me, and this idea of go out before us is something that kind of kept coming back up. And after the class, and then for class today, I went back over and tried to collect some thoughts about that. You know, so what would a king do that a judge wouldn't do? And we see these things in verse 20. And this idea of going out before us, when a judge was out before them. So let's say the go out before us is associated with leading the people. Judges always led by God's authority. Now, they may not have always followed God. Later on, there were bad judges, but the idea that it was a judge was judging the nation, bringing them back out, trying to right the ship in a sense, but it was always by God's authority. On the other hand, a king is a symbol. He's a figurehead. So when you talk about go out before you, you think about the King of England, the Queen of England, you think about that's a representative of the nation. Somebody you can look to, and this is our person. This is our guy. This is our girl. When you think about kings in secular history, how did they come to that position?
By blood.
Okay, but they can't all be born into it. So how, there's a bloodline associated with it, but How did the first kings or monarchs become that? This is something I studied. So ma'am. So that's kind of the idea. They conquered. There was accolades. They were popular. They were the strongest. They were the richest. They were the most powerful, smartest, best looking. They were a great warrior. And then you had this idea of they hailed from a bloodline. As kings continued on, this king or that king. And I was reading up on England England. And it's interesting to me that there was an elder, and then the son took and just became a king of it. So this elder had conquered different peoples, and then his son decided, well, he's going to become the king. And that's kind of how the monarchy was established there back in the 900s, 925, something like that. But that's just kind of the way it is. There was popularity associated or anything like that. And that king becomes a symbol. a physical representation of the nation. They're tangible. I mean, they can be shown off. And they're a figurehead. I mean, does that make sense? You can kind of parade them out there. They're the ones who lead you into battle. They're the ones who are doing those things. Agree or disagree? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. They didn't. And so, again, this idea that, well, you're our king, and so you're going to amass these things. You need to have the power, the wealth. You need to be able to show off our nation. So you think about when you go to capitals, that's where all the money seems to be, or that's where the elegance or the grandeur is. You know, that's where our person resides. That's not the way God had intended it with judges. They ruled through good. They ruled by God's authority. They were God's instrument. And so, as we talk about this, as we move into this, I want to make some correlations to our study this evening when it talks about Saul becoming king. But one thing I did put on here, and as we look, we'll see this in today's time, because this is how that kind of comes about. We don't need to choose leaders or follow leaders because they're powerful, that they're beautiful, that they're rich, larger than life, talented, popular, notable, famous. That's not a qualification to lead. Sometimes we get kind of wrapped up in the idea that somebody's famous or they're smart in one field, and so they should know everything. They can lead us in all aspects of life. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that. I don't think in this crowd will be controversial, but I think about our presidency, Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Okay, I think you can make a direct correlation to the fact that Biden didn't win it, Trump lost it. People didn't want this person, and their alternative was this. Okay, could we have found a better leader than the two that we have? I think so. But that's kind of the idea, that you don't like somebody over here, so you just choose somebody over there. That's not a qualification. We pick the best candidate. Let's pick somebody who knows government, country, politics, a bunch of stuff like that. Moving on to somebody like, let's say, LeBron James. One of the most famous basketball players that there is in our time, not one of the most notable, but he's a great athlete. Is he qualified to run our nation? Qualified to tell us how to make financial investments? No, he's a good basketball player, so he's not going to tell me about my spiritual life. How about somebody like a Kim Kardashian? She is known for lifestyle, but you know, she's not going to tell me how to live my life. That she's known for this specific aspect. But people tend to gravitate to those people, and we're going to emulate our lives around that because of they're popular for one specific thing. I think about Tom Brady, not for football, but finances. You know, if y'all been reading, I think it's FTX that just crashed, the cryptocurrency company, billions of dollars poured in. He was a spokesperson for them. You know how many people poured their money into that because Tom Brady was a spokesperson? And what happened? You know, fraud, there's rampant things going on with there. And I'm not saying that he had a direct part in that, but he's a football player. But that's why we advertise with those types of people, because they'll draw in money. I think about Stephen Hawking. He's a known scientist. Is he qualified to tell me about spiritual things? No. No, he's not qualified to tell me about finances or anything else, but he's so pigeonholed here, he's not willing to look at the grander scheme of things. So I'm getting to the point that just because somebody looks a certain way or is good in one certain aspect does not mean that we should follow them. I think about people of what I would consider, I'll say, local works. So, you know, when it's time to choose somebody to help teach or teach me the gospel or help me to encourage me so spiritually. And these people will be people you know, and I'm not saying they're bad people, but you don't pick them for the qualification that I'm going to give you. So think about R.J. Stevens. Okay, R.J. Stevens was known for being a great singer-songwriter, that sort of stuff, but that's not why I should listen to him listen to him about the gospel. It should have been about the knowledge that he could impart of his faith. I think about that of Jess Jenkins. Jess is really great and known for the debates that he had in the 70s, 60s, 70s, something like that, and debating institutionalism. But is that just because he can debate institutionalism doesn't mean he should leave me my faith? It should be based on the context of what he can tell me about the Bible, his faith. I think about that from the standpoint of Don Patton, who knows a lot about creationism. But that doesn't mean he can build me up spiritually. They're good in this one specific area, and this is all going to make sense in a minute. I also think about Homer Haley. He was a known professor. He was very smart when it came to the minor prophets. But you don't listen to this one person because he's notable or notorious amongst people. You listen to him because he's teaching the gospel. He's following God. Now, why does that matter at all? That's my kind of my ramblings into our discussion this evening. Look at 1 Samuel 9. We'll look at verse 1 and 2 real quick. 1 Samuel 9:1, it says, "Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechoreth, the son of Ahah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders up, he was taller than any of the people." So, based on that, what do you know of Saul? He was handsome. Okay? He has, and this will make sense, I think, if I can draw this out. We'll see some more of it as we continue to go. He was physically a fine specimen. He was taller than anybody else. He has a pedigree. It says that he was from, his dad, Kish, was a mighty man of valor. Alright? He looks the part of a king. He looks the symbol. He looks the part of being this figurehead. As we get into this, I wonder if he was chosen because he is what the people wanted. They wanted somebody to be that part. Okay, was he the greatest choice? Well, now that's a question mark, and we'll get to some of that in a little bit. But he looked the part. Israel wants a king? Let me give you what you're looking for. Let me give you that physical representation of our nation, our greatest of the great. And we'll talk about this a little bit when we get to Goliath in some later chapters. You know, they send out their mighty warrior. He's the one we want to represent our nation. He's the best of the best. Saul looks that part. We've got to be careful. You know, God's giving the people what they want, in a sense. We got to be careful we don't follow somebody because of the way they look, but what they do for us, what they represent for us. And Israel, what they needed was a man of God who could lead them to what was right. They were a wicked nation at this point. Samuel was doing what he could, but these people in Israel were a stubborn people. We know that. And so we continue on. Any questions on that before I keep moving? It's a lot of my understanding of what of this, or my take on some of this. All right, so if we don't have any questions, we'll keep going. So what we have in these first, 14 verses, we get introduced to Saul. He's on a journey, and he's with his servant, and it kind of gives us an introduction to him and what's going on. And then we get to verse 15, and this is Samuel. It says, Now a day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel. And he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have regarded my people because their cry has come to me." I put on our paper here, on our lesson, that to me this shows that Saul, but any leader, could be an instrument of God. And this is what God's purpose was for him. He says here, "You shall anoint him to be the prince over my people Israel, and he will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines." He will be God's instrument. It will be God who delivers them, but it will be Saul who carries that out, that mission. So it's delegated authority. God is in control of all people and all nations, and his will and his purpose will be done. Now, as we continue to move through this, Saul meets Samuel, and Saul knew that Samuel was a prophet, so that he's looking for a prophet to help him find, of all things, a donkey. This is what we're looking for in our prophets, apparently, in this time. But Samuel needed to be able to convey to Saul that he was a man of God, and he wanted to pull him aside so that they could discuss the idea that he was going to be anointed. So you look at verse 20. Go back to verse 19. It says, "Samuel answered Saul and said, 'I am the seer. go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and in the morning I will let you go, and will tell you all that is on your mind. As for your donkeys which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all this desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? Saul replied, Am I not a Benjamite, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? So Samuel is telling him, and for whom is all this, for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household? He's trying to convey to him that, you know, this is, you know, you're going to be a anointed king. You know, this could all be for you in the sense that he will become king, he'll be anointed. How does Saul reply to that? Mm-hmm. So I'm the smallest tribe of Israel. And my family the least of the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Why then do you speak to me in this way? So we've got, you know, from the standpoint of, here's what Israel wants. They've got this, you know, what somebody who looks the part. But how does Saul see himself? And again, in the back of my mind as I was studying this is, why in the world did God choose Saul? Why in the world? This is the guy that God's going to anoint king? How does Saul see himself?
Small.
He sees himself as small. He sees himself this big. I'm of the smallest of tribes. I'm from the smallest of tribes. I'm from the least of all the families. It's like his self-esteem is this big. This is the guy God's anointed. Now, I'm not saying we should question it. I'm saying we should think about what's going on here as we continue on. Because that constantly kind of came up in my mind. Why Saul? So we move on down, and in chapter 10, verse 1, it says, Then Samuel took the flask of oil, poured it on his head, kissed him and said, Has not the Lord anointed you a ruler over his inheritance? When you go from me today, then you will find two men from Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin. And he goes on to tell him these things, tells him several different things that will happen to him. I'll ask you this. Why does he tell him about some events that are going to happen? So recognize him as a prophet. I mean, somebody comes finds you, and now this is interesting in and of itself. Somebody finds you and comes and pours oil on your head and says you're going to be king. You're going to believe him? Even if you've heard this is a man of God, you're going to believe him? They've never had a king before? No, this is a way that Samuel can show him that he is a man of God and that he can confirm what he's telling him. Do all the things come true? They do. They all come true. So, Saul is anointed king. Now, there's something interesting here that we should take note of, and we'll move on. It'll be interesting for our next class. It says in verse 7, It shall be when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. Verse 8 says, And you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do. Does that happen in this context? The 9 through 12? It doesn't. So there's this thing that's hanging out there that Samuel's told Saul that he should be mindful of. All these other things have come to fruition. They are to confirm what Samuel has told Saul, that he is the king. And then here's this other that will happen. Saul should understand, based on these signs and wonders that have been performed, these prophecies being fulfilled, that his anointing is from God, that Samuel is a prophet. And if that's the case, I'd be hanging on these words here, being mindful of what God through Samuel has told me, so that I can be obedient to his will. Moving on to verse 17. Any questions before I keep moving? Moving on to verse 17, it says, Therefore Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah. And he said to the sons of Israel, Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought Israel out from Egypt. And I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the power of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. And this is, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel. He says, I brought Israel up from Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians, from the power of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But you have today rejected your God, who delivers you from all your calamities and your distresses. Yet you have said, no, but set a king over us. Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans. Thus Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by Lot. Then he brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its families, and the Matrite family was taken, and Saul the son of Kish was taken. But when they looked for him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired further of the Lord, has the man come here yet? So the Lord said, behold, he is hiding himself by the baggage. So they ran and took him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. Samuel said to all the people, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there was no one like him among all the people. So all the people shouted, long live the king. So I asked the question, did Saul rise to the occasion? When the time came, he's been anointed by God, his prophecy has been fulfilled. Did he rise to the occasion? This is the guy God chose? It is the guy God chose. I never want to imply that it's not, but it's a rhetorical question in the sense that, why him? It just kind of keeps coming back in my mind. Why him? This is the guy God chose. And I'll continue to pose the question, is God giving them what they asked for? A symbol? A figurehead? Somebody who looks the part? Is he going to be a good king? What were they after? They wanted to be like all the other nations. All right? Did he have substance? He had no self-worth. We can see that. He didn't rise to the occasion. It's interesting to me as an Israelite, if you've heard the stories from the time of, and they continue to go back to coming out of Egypt and then conquering the lands, and then God continues to deliver the people from their messes they made and Judges, you know God is all-powerful, almighty, and capable. And then he has anointed you, and these prophecies have been fulfilled. Why wouldn't you rise to the occasion? You have God on your side. He's told you. We talked about the statutes and ordinances, commandments, judgments. If you do these things, God will be with you. Saul had little esteem, and it seems like he had little faith. Not because he had no faith. We'll see that he has some, but little esteem and little faith. And yet he's the one that God chose. Now I asked, I've already mentioned this. I put in here, you know, what were the observations you can make based on 9:1 and 2 and 10:22-24? He looks the part. He definitely looks like what they're wanting. But that doesn't make him a good king. Now verse 25, it says, then Samuel told the people the ordinances of the kingdom and wrote them in the book and placed it before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his house. What ordinances, what were the ordinances of the kingdom?
Being chosen by God, one from among the people, no foreigner to be king. Whoever was chosen was to write a copy of the law on the scroll in the presence of the Levite priest and read it all the days of his life.
No, that's what I wanted. No, that's what you. My breath was in preparation for a comment. No, turn over to Deuteronomy 17. I'm assuming that's where you got your answer from. It's where I got mine from. Deuteronomy 17. This is what I believe Samuel is appealing to when he talks about the ordinances of the kingdom. Like Susan said, and we'll read this context, but in verse 14 it says, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you and possesses it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, which, pause for a second, if you ever wanted to know if God was all-knowing, he set this before them, how many years beforehand? He went ahead and put this in there in case something like this were happen, or did he know it was going to happen? It's there, Verse 15, "You shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as a king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman." Verse 16, "Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself." Now stop for a second. It's interesting, you know, from the, Susan didn't put this in her answer, and it's kind of an odd thing to put in there, but this idea that you should not multiply horses for yourself. What are your thoughts on why that's in there? I'm asking y'all. I have a theory, but the key to me is in the latter part of the verse. Yes. So that it says, "Nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said, you shall never return that way." He said, you're not supposed to go back. And I mean, even in our day and time, Arabian horses are known, very popular, very, very well known breed of horse. But I don't want you to go back. So don't multiply horses. Don't allow that to cloud your judgment. Don't covet that sort of thing. Don't allow it to be a temptation to you. Don't allow it to draw you away from God. To do what I told you you weren't to do. And then, verse 17, what does he tell you? Not tell you. Don't multiply wives. Why? Same thing. Or else his heart will turn away. The idea is that God said not to go back to Egypt. I'm your God. I've given you the land. Don't multiply wives, or else your heart will turn away. Again, interesting that's included now, knowing what we know is to come. Nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. So was it wrong for a king to amass gold and silver? You can speak up. It's not wrong. It's for himself. They were to plunder the nations. They were to amass gold. They're going to collect a lot of it when they're getting ready to build the temple. It's for himself. Again, this idea that everything's for God. Don't exalt yourself. Don't get yourself into this idea of selfishness and greed. Put God first. Don't amass riches and wealth. You've got God. He's there to lead you. Don't turn your heart away. Don't allow this massive amount of wealth cause you to covet or cause you to have this self-importance, that sort of thing. Verse 18. "Now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priest, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel." We're in Deuteronomy 17. We started first class in Deuteronomy 4. What are we talking about? Statutes, judgments, commandments. Keep it in front of your face. Keep it on your heart. Observe all the words of the law and these statutes, so that he may not turn aside from the commandments to the right or to the left. And so that he and his sons may continue long in the kingdom in the midst of Israel. God had a plan. Continue to read and study. Continue to read and study. Teach it to your children, and you'll be blessed. You know, the kingdom will be long with you. These are the ordinances. This is what a king should be. Essentially, don't worry about things. I'll bless you. Don't get caught up in horses, money, wives, all this other stuff. The idea is that you abide by my will. Follow my judgments, my commandments, and you'll be blessed. The kingdom will last a long time. And then we go back to Deuteronomy 4:7. I forget. My mind's mush. But, you know, the idea that you'll be known by these things. You know, people will see that these commandments, these statutes, and they'll ask, well, what they'll hear of these things and how wise they are and what God is with them. And God will be known through these things, through their acts and through the laws that they're studying and then spreading. These are the ordinances. Is it important? I say so. There's going to be a lot of kings afterward. Did they do it? You can see a lot of kings didn't follow this, and you can see what happened. They were led to destruction. All right. Questions, comments, concerns?
Well, they were supposed to preserve God's word, and that was part of the king's thing. And that's why when you get to Josiah later on, you know, and it's the people wept because, you know, they found the word for Hebrew and found the law. People did not preserve, the kings did not preserve God's law. God was just patient and kind, didn't just wait.
He was. Well, I think there are times, I know that we take for granted what we have in our hand right now. We have the inspired word in our hand. I have my own copy, you have your own copy, I've got 5-6 copies at the house. My kids have a copy, Melissa does. I've got it on a tablet, I've got it on a computer, I've got it on my phone. It'll read to me. I've got all that. The king was to write his own law in the presence of the Levitical priest, because it's not like there was a printing press back then. Now, there are not very many copies of this, and that he could have his own copy. He shall write for himself a copy of the law. It will be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life. It's most important for that king to have that with him all the time, so he can keep God in front of him, so he can know what God's will is, so he can do God's will. Not every Israelite had this, but it was important for the king to have it, so he knew what the will of God was, and he could be obedient to it. We are. Nothing's new under the sun. And that's kind of the thing that I keep thinking about. We have 1,000 copies, we have one copy. And if we're not willing to use it, to abide by it, to study it, keep it in front of our faces, oral or written, you know, it's no good to us if we're not willing to listen to study. All right, so moving on to chapter 11 of 1 Samuel. So here we have this this Ammonite attack. And so in verse 5, it says, "Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen, and he said, 'What's the matter with the people that they weep?' So they related to him the words of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry, and he took a yoke of an oxen and cut them in pieces, and he sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." Then the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. He numbered them. Verse 9, they said to the messengers who come, "Thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, 'Tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you will have deliverance.' So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Then the men of Jabesh said, 'Tomorrow we will come out to you. You may do so, come out to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you.'" So Saul leads the army against the Ammonites, and they prevail. Now, Saul may have been a man of weak or little faith, but at least in this moment, we see that Saul has some faith. Look over at, I'll ask it in the class. I have questions for a reason, right? So who was the victory attributed to? It was attributed to the Lord. You know, Saul did attribute that to the Lord. Verse 13 says, "But Saul said, 'Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has accomplished the deliverance of Israel.'" You know, again, Saul he's not coming off looking real great early on. He's got a lot of things going against him. He's got a lot, you know, God didn't want a king. People have rejected him, so he gives them what they want. But in some ways, you wonder what kind of quality he's given them. Does that mean Saul couldn't be a good king? No. He may look the part. Can he grow into the part? Yeah, he can grow into the part. He may not have had the greatest of faith, but we see here that Saul attributed this victory to the Lord. "Not a man shall be put to death. The Lord has accomplished the deliverance of evil." maybe he's getting on the right track. Yes, sir.
But, you know, when you're reading these things about Saul, he was no worse than Moses. Moses, when God chose him, he went up there and he's standing before the burning bush. All he has is excuses.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, it's not how you start, it's how you finish.
It is. You know, that's, we'll get into in the next class a little bit more about Saul, but it's interesting to me that, again, he was the one chosen, and why. Alright, move on to verse 14. It says, "Then Samuel said to the people, 'Come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there.' So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they also offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly." Now it's interesting, I skipped this verse. Go back to verse 12, it says, "Then the people said to Samuel, 'Who is he that said Saul shall reign over us? Bring the men that we must put them to death.'" So we skipped this earlier in the reading. If you noticed, when Saul was anointed king and presented as king, there were people who questioned that. Now Saul has led them to victory, attributes it to the Lord. Now this is what Saul's saying: not a man should be put to death. You know, those people are questioning. He says, you know, leave them alone. And that's what they're kind of badgering those people. Who said? Look what Saul's done for us now. You're questioning it, but look what he's done for us. We'll move into chapter 12. And here's Samuel. Verse 1, it says, "Then Samuel said to all Israel..." Let me make sure I got time. Nope, I'm not going to read it for the sake of time. So, the first five verses, Samuel attests to his credibility, that he's pure, he's righteous, and obedient. Why would you do that? Why do you think he did that?
Because he felt rejected.
He felt rejected. But it's also as I'm gonna give you my credentials. Not that we're about credentials, but let me give you my credentials real quick. I'm above reproach. I've been pure. I've been righteous. I've been obedient to God's will. You recognize that. So what I'm about to say next, don't be saying it's not true, because you just attested to my credibility. He goes on and what does he explain to him, 6 through 12?
The Lord did all this.
The Lord did all this. You had a king. So let me give you my credentials. You challenge those. They didn't challenge them. So then let me tell you, let me explain something to you that you forgot. It's the Lord who did this stuff. He brought you out of Egypt. He saved you time and again. Verse 9, it says, "But they forgot the Lord their God, and so he sold them into the hands of Sisera. And, you know, you cried out, and you were asking for forgiveness, and God brought you out." He's sitting there saying, look, you had a king. You had a king, and you rejected him. Move on to, verse 12, it says, "When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said, 'No, but a king shall reign over us,' although the Lord your God was king." Here, that's kind of the culmination of that. You had a king, although the Lord your God was your king. So verse 13, "Now therefore, here's the king whom you have chosen, whom you have asked for, and behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him, and listen to his voice, and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and also the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. If you will not listen to the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the command of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers." Now, he's synonymous. He's using the idea of authority here. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and listen to his voice and not rebel against the command of the Lord, then both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord. You know, the idea is that he set a king over you. And if you're willing to be obedient to the Lord and be obedient to your king, then you'll be blessed. You'll be servants of the Lord. If you don't listen to the voice of the Lord, and you, by extension, you don't follow this king, but rebel against the command of the Lord, this king rules because God allows it by God's will, then the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. Verse 16, even now take you and take your stand and see the great things which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call to the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. And he does. He sends thunder and rain. In verse 18, it says, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. And the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God so that you may not die. For we have added to all our sins this evil by asking ourselves a king. It's too late now. They've done it, but they realized that they'd sinned. Samuel's rebuking them, and I would say, in 13 through 18. He's sitting there telling them, you know, you asked for it, I'm giving it to you. But you need to understand that you've rejected your God, and you need to follow him. And if you don't, then you're going to be held accountable. And so, 19 through 25, these people asked for repentance. Now, it was interesting in verse 19, this question was asked. It says, then all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God. Why the Lord your God? And I best I can answer in this, for the sake of time, we're about a minute. Best I can say is maybe that because Samuel was a prophet, he was close. They viewed him as being close to God. And by the flip of the coin, they're repenting. They're away from God. And maybe that's why they're, pray to the Lord your God. You're his representative. You're his mouthpiece. Pray to him. Your God, not, it is their God, but he's the one that's close and they feel far away. That's the best I can answer that if for the question that was asked. Verse 22, let me read this real quick. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. What do you think is meant by that? For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name. They can. To me, this is, God's a man of his word. He's a deity. He's going to keep his covenant. He said it over and over again. I mean, you know, on account of his great name. If you don't have your word, if you don't have your reputation, what do you have? If God were to abandon them, it would undo all this. Because of the covenant he made to your forefathers, you are my chosen people, and I will uphold my end of the bargain. So because of my great name, because of your forefathers, this is why. I'm pleased that I have you as a people for myself, for himself. All right, I think we're out of time.